Chapter 1, Genesis. Finis origine pendit. In the beginning. There's a lot of blaspheming to get done, so might as well get started. Please not to take offense. Those terrific Abrahamic religions. Way back, something like 1500 BCE, an Egyptian got in hot water for murder. This may have been the crown prince of Egypt, Ramses, who disappeared from Egyptian records when Queen Hatshepsut died. Fleeing into the desert alone is a rough deal, unless you have quite an entourage. He got together with a band of folks, possibly going by the name Habiru, who are recorded as invading Canaan in 1480 BCE. Naturally, he spoke their language at best with a heavy accent. Hence, his translator Aaron did his speaking for him. Once out on the desert, he knew the best way to dominate as a leader is to speak with the authority of a single god and have some of this magic writing as proof. That way, opposition becomes heresy, which is easy to justify punishing with death. So he went off and made some tablets, amazing the illiterate flock. First thing, he had his closest aides kill 3,000 of his adopted people for idolatry, which they didn't know was against the law that hadn't been made yet. This arbitrary killing was very effective in setting up absolute power. He continued liquidating his own after that, which established him as a great hero. His tribe proceeded to follow his orders to invade, rape, steal, and commit genocide repeatedly, which is always popular when it works. See German newsreels from 1940. The Good Book tells all about it. Sure enough, his legacy only grew with time, just as with Genghis Khan or Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great, who were even more effective mass murderers with endless supplies of women or men in their beds. With Yahweh the Thunder God on his side, Moses is an object of religious veneration by pious, decent, devoted spiritual seekers all over the world. Terrific. Now, I have a lot of reverence and respect for Jesus, not because of some book or because of some church, but because of personal transcendental experiences. But Christianity, as we have it today, was not founded by Jesus. It was founded by Paul, who never knew Jesus. He thought he knew Jesus through transcendental experiences and got it all wrong. So I'd better be careful. The people who did know Jesus personally considered Paul a liar and a most dangerous man. Some even wanted to kill him. Something about circumcision and kosher food. The Good Book tells all about it. After that start, Paul's Orthodox Church bumped off the competition, and its creed was mutilated repeatedly by the Roman Empire and a whole slew of priests and kings whose main interest was their jobs and power. Thus the irony of decent, intelligent, compassionate Anglicans doing good works, including protesting capital punishment, in a denomination founded by Henry VIII, who executed 70,000 people in his reign. Terrific. So along in 620 CE, Muhammad, stuck out in the sand in the middle of nowhere, saw what the game is with the magic writing and the messages from God from many examples like Moses. By his own account, he was a horny guy and knew that power and violence could get him all the action he could possibly handle. And the ultimate power and violence came from the guy upstairs. Illiterate himself, he dictated a series of very convenient messages from the Archangel Gabriel. Oddly enough, for someone in a position to know all and see all in eternity, Gabriel neglected to inform Muhammad of anything he wouldn't already know in 7th century Arabia. Thus, all the mythology of the Bible was taken as fact, along with all the other current beliefs of geography and cosmology. Muhammad's Allah was even more psychotic than Yahweh. more vengeful, more prone to smiting anyone in the way, and eager to inflict eternal torture on infidels and apostates. Allah demanded absolute submission, since that was the whole point of the exercise, hence the name Islam. Thus, behaving in a godly manner fit right into a martial life. Goebbels commented that he approved of Islam as a martial religion from which it was simple to recruit fascists. This was crucial to progress in the Balkans. The revelations Muhammad made up were perfect for getting him all the women he desired, including a child. He had absolute power of life and death, and exercised the option of killing those who criticized his new religion with no regrets, which was the style at the time. His successors, when not fighting each other, continued conversion by the sword until most of the known world was under the control of Islam. And they still threaten to kill people who make entirely accurate statements about historical fact. You can be killed for saying, quote, you can be killed for saying, quote, you can be killed for saying, quote, Islam is violent. Close quote, close quote, close quote. Terrific. A yogi might add, in the case of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, spiritual people managed to create a framework for devotion, insight, and profound development. All three religions produced great saints, and billions turned to them for solace, moral guidance, and inspiration. Most lived peaceful and tolerant lives. The essential hustle of the origins of the faiths remains enshrined in the scriptures. Other religions have much the same situation. Modern times. LDS. Right letters, wrong order. Cut to 1827 in upstate New York. Joseph Smith knew all about the power of magic writing from God and what it had done for Moses and Muhammad, among others. Islam was a particularly tempting model for a new American religion that would give him unlimited power and women on demand. The most likely story seems to be that Sidney Rigdon, Oliver Cowdery, and Smith extensively altered a romantic novel by Solomon Spaulding that became the Book of Mormon. There was also material added from James Adair's A History of the American Indians from 1775 and, no relation, Ethan Smith's View of the Hebrews or the Tribes of Israel in America. Subsequently, Smith published Book of Abraham, an imaginary translation of a typical first-century Egyptian funerary text he claimed was written by Abraham himself. These books were perfect tools for founding the new cult of Latter-day Saints. Smith and his cohorts knew very well that people are far more willing to accept and become passionately devoted to the wildest, most absurd, and obviously fabricated tales than they would be to more mundane stories that just might be true. Once the sanctity of religious faith cloaked these books and the leadership, total obedience followed. Smith soon had many wives, and other leaders followed suit. Blood atonement, execution for crossing the church, was fundamental in the first several decades, as declared by Brigham Young himself. Although Mormons have destroyed, altered, or locked away many documents from the 19th century, enough survives in the public record to have a good idea of what went on. My ancestors came into this story right at the beginning. They fought in the Mormon Wars in Missouri and Illinois, walked across the plains with handcarts to Utah, fought the Mexicans in California in 1849 in the Mormon Brigade, and were some of the first Anglo settlers in Nevada. Surviving documents show slavish devotion and absolute obedience, with a few interesting exceptions. One such exception speaks to what life was like in an isolated theocracy that followed LDS ideals. One day in Salt Lake City, Brigham Breedham Young decided that one of my ancestors, the 13-year-old daughter of a local family, should be his next wife. The parents were horrified and decided on drastic action. That night, they wrapped rags around the wheels of their wagon and snuck silently out of town. Thankfully, they pulled it off without fatal consequences and survived to continue life as good church members. One of my ancestors is Lorenzo Dow Young, Brigham's brother. Another tale related by my father, although without telling me exactly who was involved, was a touch more grim. A German immigrant convert to the faith and his wife came out west and set up a homestead not far from where some of my ancestors lived. A wagon load of local women visited the farm to welcome them and saw that he had hitched his wife to the plow. That way, the milch cow would not get tired and would give more milk. Horrified, the women told their menfolk, who then paid a visit of their own. They killed and buried the man and brought the woman back with them to find a better life. End of story. My father's mother's brother was Homer Achilles Brown. Yes, it's spelled Achilles, but this was the frontier. Lived from 1853 to 1886. Chill was guide and cook for Major Powell's expedition mapping the Grand Canyon. Exposure to the elements and lack of treatment led to both he and his brother dying young from tuberculosis. One of my ancestors had an argument with a man who bunked him on the head with a shovel. He wasn't quite the same after that. Some years afterwards, he saw the assailant on the street in another town and asked him who he was. When my ancestor was satisfied that it was the man he wanted, he pulled a pistol and shot the bum dead. The jury of his LDS peers ruled not guilty by reason of served him right. Sometimes sharing the same cult comes in handy. Although polygamy was supposed to have ended in the main church after 1890, this was not the case. My grandfather, Joseph Eldridge Robinson, 1867 to 1941, was the president of the California Mission starting in 1901 for more than 20 years, and had five wives, three of which were acknowledged. All were wed after 1890. He was in San Francisco for the 1906 earthquake, which destroyed the mission headquarters. Afterwards, he moved to Los Angeles. My father, Heber Brown Robinson, was born in Bountiful, Utah in 1915. His birth certificate read Heber Brown, but later his name was legally changed. His family moved to Arizona when he was 12. Life was difficult on the farm in those days, with dirt floors and frequently no shoes. Dad missed a lot of school since shoes were required. He was traumatized by ill treatment from his siblings and absence of his father. At about age 12, he decided to kill himself in the kitchen, using a knife to make as big a mess as possible. As he was about to stab himself, he suddenly had an overwhelming vision where he was transported to the Mormon version of heaven. All his relatives and the prophets and so forth were there. When he came out of it, he put the knife away and continued on with his life and remained convinced in the validity of the faith for about 8 more years. And a yogi might interject. There is no lack of testimonials about direct spiritual experiences fitting the dictates of the LDS creed. True, some seem rather repetitive, like the loaf of bread that goes missing in the kitchen at the same time a distant kin is in need who miraculously finds it, yum yum. Still, such reports are extremely common. Other people in other faiths likewise report vivid transcendental experiences that tend, for the most part, to comply with what their religion describes. Something like 40% of Americans say they've experienced the presence of a loved one after they died in a convincing and meaningful way. People whose belief system denies the possibility of having any spiritual experience tend not to have them, except in the most extreme circumstances, like near-death, out-of-body journeys, or psychedelic trips, which overwhelms their programming. What the heck is going on? My father's interpretation many years afterwards, when he was an adamant atheist and materialist, was that his central nervous system saw a threat to its existence and did what it had to do to keep him alive. It had to manufacture an experience in keeping with his concepts to be meaningful and effective, but this was not evidence for anything actual transcendental. But the mystery is more fundamental than this. The nature of our awareness at any time, even our normal waking state, is unknown. Who am I? Why am I here? How did I get here? Where am I going? Best to have something to say about these matters in an autobiography. This book would be worthless if it didn't, and inaccurate if it didn't apply to everyone. As I am not omniscient, my ramblings will be yet another guess compared to the guesses of the past, but at least it is based on a large number of direct experiences. Everything we know is wrong. I have strolled down the aisles of library stacks in the philosophy section and found no answers, just books citing other books going back to Plato, who didn't know either. They could do no better than guess and compare their guesses with other guesses. You pays your money and you takes your choice. Clearly, if thousands of years of the best minds of the Western world could get no further than this, then pushing an intellectual approach as far as it can possibly go is ineffective and misleading. What about the answers that come from contemplation? Savants and saints all through history have been contemplating their respective navels and writing the results of their divine inspiration or passed them down in oral traditions. Some of the subject matter is beyond our ability to observe, but much concerns our material world and can be directly measured and tested. Without exception, the cosmologies describing the material universe in all the world's traditional cultures are at wide variance from what we now know through science. Just about everything that could be gotten wrong was gotten wrong, and by a very wide margin. Mormonism is an extreme case. One would expect the cosmology and history of a deliberate fraud to be far from accurate. Try talking Hebrew to a Navajo and see how well it works. My ancestors gave it a shot, and it will be hard to find a chariot wheel in pre-Columbian Central American ruins. But no religion, not the Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, Jews, animists, nobody came up with a heliocentric solar system, a spherical earth, gravity, or evolution. Only observation and reasoning, logos, came up with such truths, starting with the ancient Greeks and continuing on today. Mythos not only didn't give correct answers, it continues to fight against them. If transcendental insight was valid, they should have known of things they couldn't yet observe, like galaxies, chemical elements, atoms and particles, and so forth. Not only that, if such insight were accurate, then seers all over the world would see the same thing, and religions would all be equivalent. Clearly, they are not. The universe does not play by 1,000 different rule books at once. If it did, electrons would be very confused. Since the Renaissance, the fundamental problem with religion in its relationship to science has been, if we got the things we can observe wrong, how do we know we are right about the things we can't observe? This problem has produced what we see today. Fundamentalists insist on literal truth for their mythology, while the moral authority and spiritual guidance of religions erodes among those who accept modern science as accurate about our physical world. Science, in turn, does not address transcendental affairs that are critical for our lives. The consequences are grave. Religions clearly have no monopoly on ethics. There is nothing about atheism or materialism that specifically denigrates compassion, selflessness, and a willingness to love and serve others, or so I've heard. And every conceivable crime has found a happy home in all major religions. But the logical implication of materialism is that people are just bags of chemicals with some sort of biocomputer whizzing away inside. Our awareness, taken as emerging from sufficient complexity, is an illusion. Love reduces to an evolutionarily advantageous hormone-induced behavior produced by selfless DNA. Killing a person is just turning off the computer and recycling the bag. If such a philosophy were accurate and actually practiced, then we would be making food, soap, and leather goods out of very old people, criminals, and anyone who dies and leaves a fresh corpse, as we do so remorselessly with animals. I have never met a materialist, however devoted to the cause, who treated his mother like she was nothing more than a bag of chemicals. However, I never met Stalin. It's hard to take materialism seriously when its most ardent advocates can only live true to their convictions if they are criminally insane. Note that the savage cruelty practiced on our industrial farms, raising poultry, swine, and cattle in horrendous conditions, is only possible with the materialistic view that animals are unselfconscious machines. On the bright side, industrial farming is entirely dependent on oil and gas and ruins the environment on which it depends. Thus, it will end soon. But I digress. Now to my mother's side. My mother's mother's father was a circuit-riding Baptist preacher in the plains of North Texas in the late 19th century. When his ex-Confederate mother came to visit, he had to hide the U.S. flag under the bed. My grandmother, Fanny Bell Bowles, 1894 to 1990, did not accept his teaching that Negroes had no souls, which was the style at the time, and by age 14 accepted the idea of reincarnation. Naturally, this caused consternation in the household. And why didn't the Baptists believe in the possibility of reincarnation, or at least the Greek idea about transmigration of souls? Especially since it was widely accepted in the first 500 years of the Christian Church by leaders such as St. Augustine, Clement of Alexandria, St. Gregory of Nyssa, Justin Martyr, and St. Jerome. And most significantly, by Origen. Well, as mentioned above, church doctrine was defined primarily by kings and priests to maximize their power. Against the adamant protests of Pope Vigilius, who was imprisoned for his troubles, Justinian, one of the most psychopathic of Roman emperors, ordered the Fifth Ecumenical Council in 553 CE. This was attended mostly by bishops from the East, with a lonely six from the West, to condemn Origen and the heresy of Nestorianism. The reasoning was that if souls had pre-existed with God, Christ wasn't unique. And if everyone thought they were a child of God, they might not pay taxes or submit to the authority of the church or the state. And if everyone eventually went back to God after many lifetimes, then the church would not be the unique and necessary path to salvation. Damn universalists! After much dissension and struggle, eventually the Orthodox Church fell into line and reincarnation became heresy forever after. Truth be told, the situation was much more complex than this, but there are many books about it already, and I can only stray a bit here and there. Corners must be cut. Meanwhile, my maternal grandfather, David van der Kooi, was born into a Dutch family in Ohio in 1882. He lied about his age to get into the Spanish-American War at age 15 in 1898 and fought in Cuba. He stayed in the army, serving under Pershing, fighting first Pancho Villa and then in World War I. Shot in the arm by friendly fire, he returned to John Hopkins Hospital for treatment, where he met Fanny, who was a nurse there. One can only imagine what nursing was like during the influenza pandemic. This was an odd match, to say the least. Her fellow nurses says, "You're marrying him?" Fanny was very much a pacifist, involved with the Quakers, and, at least by the 30s, a vegetarian. David was fresh from the trenches, an experience that drove many stable men insane. Fanny told me that she felt it was her karma, that she had a duty of some sort to fulfill by marrying this man despite the difficulties. And difficulties there were. One example, David would deliberately drive his pregnant wife at high speed on primitive mountain roads, which terrified her. There were many more severe problems, best not specified here. My mother, Frances, was born in Pasadena, California in 1925, followed by her sister, Helen, who died in her early 20s, and brother David. The elder David died of cancer in 1931. Fanny got a master's degree in 1940 at USC and went on to found the Occupational Therapy Department at Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas. Fanny was a fitness nut, using vitamins as soon as they were produced. She became convinced as to the importance of posture and strapped my mother and her sister into harnesses, which they slept in every night. With her parenting style by turns excessively controlling and absent with her work and studies, life was not happy. Music was very important in the Vandercoy family. Mom played piano and was timpanist in the orchestra of the progressive high school she attended. Although hindered with some degree of dyslexia, she developed very good pianistic skills, as well as having a fine voice. Helen was a violist and David played cello. Later, he went to Eastman School of Music and was cellist in the Blair Quartet at Vanderbilt in Nashville, where he taught for many years. Meanwhile, my father was 17 years old and in California when FDR ran against Hoover in 1932. He told me about widespread plans afoot that if Hoover won, there would be armed revolt against the government. The idea would not be a communist revolution, but a restoration of constitutional government. But of course, once something like that starts, who knows where it goes? People were that fed up with misrule by organized money. If the alternative was organized mob, then so be it. After FDR's election, the FBI came around and let people know that this had better not happen, and everyone pretty much agreed that there wasn't any taste for revolution anymore. They just voted it in instead. Now the Army's machine guns were pointed at the industrial goons instead of at the strikers. Wall Street never caught on. How lucky they were. They lived to pillage another day. Today. But bad times persisted. Dad was going to school, working, and sending money home to help support his mother, despite having quite a few brothers with very good jobs who didn't bother. As the youngest son, he had been designated as the one to provide for his mother. He quit a job in disgust that paid 60 cents an hour, only to be forced to accept one that paid 15 cents. The experiences of these years scarred him and his generation for life. For instance, in 1973, I suggested that he, Mom, and I ride in the car to go about 3 blocks to save time over walking. He objected, since it would cost 5 cents in gasoline, and this was during my graduation from Phillips Academy, Andover. One of his brothers was Radburn Robinson, baritone in The King's Men. This male vocal quartet was quite successful in the 30s through the 50s, singing in many movies. Fibber McGee and Molly on the radio for 15 years, providing theme music for radio and television shows and recordings. Rad was the voice of the coroner in The Wizard of Oz. After the breakup of the quartet, Rad became one of the Mormon mafia that oversaw the business holdings of Howard Hughes in Las Vegas and was in charge of the entertainment at 5 casinos. And yet, when my grandfather Joseph was dying of cancer in 1941, none of the prosperous brothers and half-brothers, all 20, would pitch in to buy him a hospital bed. That was left to my father, the poorest of them all, to provide. These and many other experiences, some violent, embittered Dad permanently. He abandoned Mormonism in his early 20s. He studied at Berkeley and then at Star King School for the Ministry to train to become a Unitarian minister. Music was also very important to him. He was active in L.A. opera scene as a bass. His friend Dick Nost founded the America Opera Guild, which championed the cause of opera in English. Dad had a running bet with George London as to which of them would be the first to sing Boris Godunov in Moscow. George won. Dad showed me a newspaper clipping from this time that puzzled me. There was a picture of him with an eye patch and a concert review. He was a soloist with an orchestra for the premiere of Ghost Drums of Oglala. I don't know the composer. He invited his brothers to the concert, but they said, "Don't want to hear Heber bawl," and one punched him in the face. The patch hid the resulting black eye. Gotta love that music business. During his time at Berkeley, Dad was writing a paper about LDS early history. One evening at a bar, he mentioned in conversation what he was doing and that he was using records in the Berkeley Library. A few days later, he went back to the library and found the documents missing. The librarian was very upset at the theft, but was familiar with the problem. Dad kept his mouth shut about such things after that. Sometime in the 30s, my father met Paramahansa Yogananda during a group session teaching meditation. Dad spoke with him and got some personal guidance, but didn't think much of it. When he told me this in the 70s, I was much impressed. I and my sister had read Autobiography of a Yogi, and we both felt deeply inspired by Yogananda's life, devotion, spiritual practice, and message. It was only much later, when the internet made information easily obtained, that I started to wonder. Yogananda, like many other spiritual leaders, didn't have much knowledge about matters outside his expertise. Mystical omniscience didn't help. Quotes, "A master brain like that of Mussolini does more good than millions of social organizations of group intelligence. The average man cannot think clearly. He needs the mastermind of a dictator in order to think right and do right." Another quote, "Hitler is to be admired for leaving the League of Nations because peace can never be obtained by the victor and vanquished attitude, but on a basis of equality and brotherhood. America, France, and Great Britain should reduce their armaments first and thereby destroy the desire of Japan, Russia, and Germany to become equally armed." Close quote. These statements were made in 1933, soon after Hitler gained power, but after repressions of opponents had begun. And Mussolini had led Italy for 11 years. No retraction was ever issued. Gurus cannot be wrong. What's a spiritual seeker to do? When we entered World War II, Dad was in Southern California and registered as a conscientious objector. This was not the safest thing to do at the time, but he was 6'3" and at least 250 pounds, which helped avoid attack. With his skills from factory work, he got a job as a machinist in war plants. In the early 40s, a popular magazine, not sure which one, published an article saying that a bomb based on atomic fission using uranium could destroy a city. Dad read this and found it interesting. I think he mentioned that FBI tracked down issues of the magazine, including his, and confiscated them. One day, government agents of some sort came to the plant and took all the drill bits and tools that contained uranium, which was very useful as it is extremely hard, so he figured we were building an atomic bomb. The agents were using a Geiger counter to find the uranium. One of the machinists led them on a wild goose chase using his radium-dialed watch in the bottom of a barrel of scrap. Pissed them off. Life in those plants was not easy. One day, an Army Air Force officer came in and told the machinists to follow him to take a look at something. In a hangar, shortly before this, a worker had been asked to sit in the cockpit of a fighter plane while some tests were done. He was told not to touch anything and do exactly as he was told. The sun was in his eyes, and he saw what looked like a shade over his head and pulled it down. That wasn't a shade. It was a shield, and it automatically activated an explosive charge under the seat, ejecting him all over the ceiling. The officer said, "See what happens when you don't do what you're told." I don't know what year this happened. It could have been after World War II. When production of the B-29 started, he was a key member of the team pouring molten magnesium into molds for engine blocks, one of the many innovations of this aircraft. The Army threatened to draft him, but a Navy officer intervened and said they'd sign him into the Navy and put him right back in the plant, and the Army backed off. Using his considerable strength, he used a ladle to transfer the molten metal into the molds. One day, someone handed him a damp ladle, and on contact with the molten magnesium, there was an immediate fire. Terrible damage resulted, and Dad was in the hospital for weeks. Production halted until they could bring him back on a stretcher to oversee the work. Magnesium engine blocks, you might wonder? Yes, several planes were lost when the blocks caught fire and burned through the wing spar. Not all innovation is so great. The bomber that dropped so many tons of incendiary bombs was itself incendiary. Family life, oh joy, oh rapture. By this time, my parents had met, and they wed in July 1945. Both had come from chaotic family situations, had serious personal problems, and did not know how to have a happy marriage and domestic tranquility. They never did find out. One thing they shared was a deep commitment to pacifism and civil rights. One day, not long after Pearl Harbor, my father met Joe Kikuchi, a young Japanese man whose family faced internment. Dad found this to be a clear violation of his rights and of no use in defense of the country. I'm not sure about all the details, but Dad said that the Kikuchis had a large orchard that they had to leave behind when they were taken to the internment camps. When they came back, Dad regularly got gift boxes of fruit from their farm. I found in the documents left by my parents a photograph of them enjoying a picnic in the orchard in Sevastopol, California, in the spring of 1946, with the large Kikuchi family. About this time, the LDS Church was annoyed with his apostasy, which he had never formalized. Two guys showed up at the door wearing fedoras and suits, knocked, and Mom answered. They were there with a summons to ecclesiastical court. When my dad came to the door, they were not quite so bold, given his size and evident strength, but they proceeded to read out the summons. He just shut the door in their faces. Undaunted, they continued to read until they had finished and then left. That was the last contact my father had with LDS. In fact, to my knowledge, after leaving California, he never met anyone on his side of the family, which is also true for all of his children. This is common when someone leaves the Mormon Church. Shortly after, in 1946, the new couple left for a Unitarian church in New Olmsted, Ohio. My sister Catherine Claire was born in late 1946, and my brother John David in mid-1948. Kathy was a very sweet-natured baby. John suffered from dyslexia. Dad sat him on his knee for many hours to teach him to speak, which he finally could at age 4. He's overcome this disability quite well. My father was not exactly the kind of person you would guess would go into the ministry. He was very intellectual, morose, and did not radiate the kind of compassion and encouragement people need to feel from their pastor. More to the point, he had a growing family and found out rather late in the game that Unitarian ministers were not supposed to live entirely off their salary. They usually came from rich families and had some other means of support. My family left North Olmsted and moved to Beverly, Massachusetts, a small city on the coast about 20 miles north of Boston, in 1948. There my father preached until 1953. There was some kind of trouble whose details were never shared with me. I heard as I am writing this from a family friend that he was dismissed for being undesirable as the leader of a congregation. He left the ministry to go back to school in Texas, once again embittered. Fanny was teaching at Texas Women's University in Denton. The plan for the family was to live with her while Dad studied. After a couple of weeks of trying this out, Kathy and John were in rebellion over the austere food. Mom was remembering why she was so eager to marry and get out of her mother's house, and Dad was not exactly overjoyed not wearing the pants in the family. Primal primate patterns took millions of years to evolve, and can't just be turned off when inconvenient. So he went out to find a job, and the Robinsons moved into their own small house next to TWU. After selling Fuller brushes, Kirby vacuums, and insurance door-to-door, he eventually got work as a machinist, which he did for the rest of his working life. He hated his work, but did his best to provide for his family with the skills and opportunities available. About this time, he started feeling the effects of arthritis, which stooped his shoulders, stiffened his back, and gave him considerable pain. The doctors gave various inaccurate diagnoses and no therapy. His job required him to be on his feet all day, leaning over a machine, which must have been hell. He didn't find out what it really was until I came down with the same disease, only much worse, finally diagnosed correctly in 1981. Mom continued her piano playing as well as art in pastels, crayon, watercolor, and oil. Although she got a bachelor's degree in advertising art at North Texas State College, she couldn't bear the thought of using it professionally. Although starting from scratch, she became a very good cook with a lot of tutelage from Dad. Her cakes and bread were quite in demand. My earliest memories date from late in 1954, seeing what looked like a dark red curtain with many folds. Enough light gets into the womb for a fetus to see. I was pretty well developed by that point, and basically just hung out until the beginning of the next chapter.